South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
But you better hurry, because there's only one line left open. We're going to talk to AJ and Kathy and Susan, and if you dial quickly, you can grab that last line. Beautiful morning out there. If you haven't been out, it feels kind of like a Northern California morning. It's just got that little bit of crispness to the air, a little bit of humidity to the air. Very, very still. Not much breeze moving at all. Just be a great day to be out walking, or as I was just discussing with my engineer, Don, it'd be a great day to be out fishing. He said it'd be a great day to be out golfing. So let's just sum it up and say it would be a great day to be outside, especially if you're gardening. So if you've got gardening questions, you know that's what we're here to talk about, and lots of things to talk about. Time to plant cool weather flowers, cool weather vegetables, time to fertilize everything in the landscape. I could go on and on, but I think we need to start out seeing what kind of situations AJ may have encountered this morning. Good morning, AJ.
Yes, Bobby, we have an unusual situation this past week.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, you know those worms that get into those live oak trees and kind of defoliate the ends of the branches where their new leaves are?
Yes, sir.
Well, my bride had to have a new driveway, so we put a new driveway in, and, you know, it's nice and white, and mm-hmm. dry, and then I noticed that there were some droppings on the concrete, and, you know, I'd blow them off with a blower, and then we got a rain come through and wetted them, and I, you know, kind of washed them off a day or so later, and then kept blowing and blowing, and I noticed stains on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And those droppings stained that concrete. Do you know what will take them off other than a new driveway?
Oh, boy. You know, probably something like they call it muriatic acid. It's dilute hydrochloric acid is what they sell at swimming pool companies. That's what they use to take stains out of swimming pools and places like that that is really hard to get them out of. I will tell you that it's probably going to be an ongoing problem, and if she wants to have that concrete stay sparkling, brand new looking, you may need to talk to one of these companies that puts sort of a sealer on the concrete. I think it's an epoxy kind of material they use that creates a smooth surface that keeps anything from soaking in. But, you know, you remember from the days we were kids, no matter how long ago that was, how chlorophyll stains, you know, how tough it is to get the green stain out of the knees of your blue jeans and things like that. Well, in effect, the leaves are just passing through the caterpillars. A lot of caterpillars, or a lot of chlorophyll comes out in the caterpillar poop. And that's what is one of the main things that does that green staining. And it's just as hard to get off the concrete as it is to get off the blue jeans. But I don't think any of your real mile cleaners are going to do it. I think you're probably going to have to go to a swimming pool company, or they might sell it at one of the big box stores or lumber yards. But what you can ask for is just muriatic acid. You're going to wear gloves. You're going to wear eye protection when you're using it. It's diluted down to the point that it's not really dangerous, but it's not something you want to get on your skin. So I think that's going to be the best hope to get that stain out of the concrete. Either that, or you're going to have to hide her glasses so she can't see them. Because I'm not sure you're going to get 100% of it out anyway. So, but that'll come the closest I know of to remedying your situation. Now, I would, think about putting out some of those little trichogramma wasp strips. It's unusual to have those caterpillars this late in the year. They usually are something that shows up just in early spring. But in anticipation of future situations that may arrive, I think I'd be getting one of those little wasp strips and putting it out every few weeks.
All right. Well, see, we always have them in the fall.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay.
Much in the spring, very little. But in the fall they are, and this year I didn't put them out, and so they got in there and did their thing.
Yeah, so, and that's the problem. The little wasp, the little trichogramma, they destroy the eggs. But once the eggs have hatched into the caterpillars, you know, that's like a mosquito going after an elephant. It's not going to do much of anything to it. So, if you feel like most of them are already hatched out, don't worry about it. If you feel like they're still hatching out, as long as there are eggs out there, those little wasps can parasitize them and keep the numbers down.
Mm-hmm. I got this one tree that's right above the driveway. It's about a 18, 24-inch diameter. How many of them strips would you hang on it?
One.
One will take care of it?
One will take care of it. You figure that every one of those little strips has 3,000 or 4,000 developing wasp larvae, and every one of those little wasps is going to get 200 or 300 eggs. So, and then every one of those 200 or 300 eggs is going to hatch out into another wasp that'll get 200 or 300 of those eggs. So, no, they recommend even in fairly densely forested area, they only put out 4 or 5 strips per acre. Now pecan growers do it a little bit heavier, just trying to protect every single pecan, but one of those strips goes a long, long way, and I think one would be plenty for that beautiful big oak tree.
All righty. Well, I'll give that a try next year if the undertaker or the sheriff don't come get me, Bobby.
Well, hang out the unwelcome sign to both of those. Well, I don't know. My sheriff's a good friend of mine, but the undertaker, I very definitely would tell him he's got the wrong address. Give him the address of a couple of politicians we know that. No, I should not say that. But boy, I'm tired of the news. I'll sure be glad when another couple of weeks go by.
Well,
AJ, always good to start the morning off with a fellow with a good sense of humor. So you get out and have a good weekend.
All right, you behave yourself. Bye.
Oh, I'll try. I don't have much choice.
All right.
Thanks, AJ.
Bye.
Goodbye. Okay, Kathy's up next. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Can you
good
hear
morning.
Me?
Good morning. I hear you fine.
Okay. I've been trying to get a hold of you for a couple of weeks, but I know your situation. I was ready to drive over there today to the nursery to talk to you. I have it's either 300 to 500 year old oak tree, within a mile of Medina Lake, on the Bandera side. And it has come out now with, chicken of the wood, also sulfur shelf with the mushrooms that are growing out of it. It's actually a rent house, and I just hate to lose that tree. And I, my renter talked to an arborist, and he said that you need to bore into it to see how badly it's infected. And, he didn't tell us anything that we could do to maybe slow the virus down.
It's not a virus.
Oh, okay.
It's actually a fungal organism. It's a fungus, and it basically attacks dead wood in a tree. Doesn't do a lot of additional damage, and you're never going to find an old oak tree around that doesn't have some dead wood in it. They call them shelf fungi. Arbor's friend David Vaughn calls them tree ears. He's the best arborist I know. He doesn't have anything, he'll talk to you over the phone. You probably don't even need to think about asking him to come out, and he doesn't. He's basically retired from climbing trees, so he's not going to try to sell you anything, but let me give you David's number, which is 210. Are you ready to write?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
210-788-4986.
Okay, and his name is David?
David Vaughn. He's the guy, he teaches the classes that our other arborists have to take if they want to become certified arborists. And just ask him if there's anything new in the treatment for shelf fungus or tree ears is what he often calls them. But I'm sure not going to push the panic button at this point. And does the growth on the tree look healthy? Is it, you know, basically just the same? Yeah. It's not anything to lose. I'm sorry.
it's not anything to lose sleep over. Thank God.
I would not lose sleep. It's something that and he will tell you if there's anything you need to do. But, you know, you get a tree that size that's probably been hit by lightning 20 times over its life or more, that's been through windstorms, that, you know, broken branches here and there. So it's hard to find one of these oaks that we call a heritage oak that doesn't have a little bit of dead wood in it. And if it has any dead wood in it, it's perfectly natural to have, you know, these fungi that are basically decomposing and breaking down that dead wood. I was kind of surprised. David was telling me recently when we were visiting that research indicates that even a hollow tree, if it has, you know, a couple of inches of wood left, I mean, it might be a huge tree that's totally hollow in the middle, it's still 80% as strong as it was when it was just a totally solid trunk. So oak trees are pretty resilient. It wouldn't have made it this long up there in Bandera County if or Medina County, whichever you're in, if it you know, wasn't a good strong tree. I always, if you have any oak wilt anywhere around you or anything like that, I'd think about putting out a little corn water tea periodically just to keep that tree's immune system, or what passes for an immune system, strong, because there's just gotten to be so much oak wilt in Kendall and Bandera and Kerr County, all up that way. But that tree's very definitely worth protecting. But give David a call and see if he recommends that you do anything. It's certainly not anything that's going to, you know, attack your tree and knock it down overnight.
Okay. My renter has actually been going as where he can reach and cleaning that off and spraying Flex Seal on where he's cleaned off. Should he be doing that, or is that?
I would not use Flex Shield for anything, and the only place that I would spray anything on is if he's actually gotten into live wood. If you expose live wood through pruning or, you know, some accident or anything happens that exposes live green wood on the tree, that is the place that potentially the insects could transfer the oak wilt fungus in, and you sure don't want to get oak wilt. But dead tissue and things like that, no danger whatsoever. And if you have, you know, it used to be if you had a cavity or something like that in a tree, everybody thought you filled them with concrete or anything like that. And the evidence is that you're doing a lot more damage than you're doing good. So I would definitely seal, and it doesn't have to be pruning paint. It can be just plain old latex paint, because it only has to stay sealed for about 10 days. But I would seal any cut made into live wood, but dead wood, dead limbs, things like that, no, don't give it a second thought.
Okay. And you said something, I know, one time about getting cornmeal from just the feed store or whatever.
Yep.
Okay, and sprinkling it around or making corn water
tea. Yeah, and helping friends, and I've been talking about this for, no, I don't know, 10, 15 years, that we found that putting out the dry cornmeal, we could reverse oak wilt. We didn't really know how it happened back then, and I've been very openly criticized by the A&M people and everybody else that says I don't know what I'm talking about. But now there's scientific evidence that it creates something we call systemic acquired resistance to oak wilt and other fungal diseases. But the fun thing we found is that you get just as much protection if you take a 5-gallon bucket of water, add about 2 cups of cornmeal, and let it soak overnight, and then just pour that water, not out around the drip line, but up within 10 feet of the trunk. And it sure does take a lot less cornmeal if you're making a few buckets of corn water tea than to try to put out. I know my friend that I buy hay from up in Sisterdale that saved a couple of giant trees with it, but I think I had to get Larry like 400 pounds of cornmeal, because that was back when we still were putting it out dry. But the corn water tea, it seems to be just as effective and uses a lot less cornmeal.
Oh, that's great information. Thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
You have a wonderful day in the Hill Country, and get ready for a weather change. I hear we're going to see in Hill Country, you're likely to see low 40s, 2 or 3 mornings coming this next week. So we'll all be happy for the cooler weather, but let's hope we're all prepared for it, Kathy. Have a great day. Thank you.
Goodbye.
All right, Susan, you'll be up next. Right now, I get to talk about the good guys and gals at Air Conditioning Service Company. And, you know, every other ad it seems like you hear on the radio is either for a water software company or an air conditioning service company. And you're wondering what makes one different from another. Well, one thing I'll tell you about air conditioning service company is their technicians are trained to work on every imaginable system out there. You don't have to worry what kind of air conditioner you have. The air conditioning service company guys are trained to service that system, to inspect it, to be sure it's operating efficiently, and to fix it if it needs fixing. That's the other big difference, is they're out to fix your old system, not just, I was talking to somebody the other day that said over the phone they told him he needed a new air conditioning system, it'd be $4,500 or something like that. No, that's not the way they work. They have great new energy efficient systems, and there comes a time when you will want to upgrade to a new system. I had to do that this past year, as a matter of fact, when the old one totally failed. But these guys want to keep your old system going as long as it's running, as long as it's economically practical, and as long as it's operating safely. And fall is a very important time to check that system for safety as well as for efficiency. Learn more. Give them a call. You can check them out on the website if you like it. StayCoolSA.com. And if you want to give them a call, easy number, 210-796-9550. 796-9550 for Air Conditioning Service Company. All right, back to gardening on a beautiful Sunday morning. Susan is next, and it'll be Glenn and Dolores. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
It's just a really nice morning out there, and it's fall, and it's just a fun time of year. What can I say?
It is beautiful. I've been listening, obviously, and I have some questions. Our yard, I know I've been hearing, you know, fertilizing, but we have some spots in our yard that seem to be more like volunteer look-alike plants that from a distance your lawn can look like a lawn, but right up close there's sprigs of grass and then all these other things. Mm-hmm. So how, I'm thinking that I'm probably looking at a plan that's going to have to take place in steps to return this to looking like a lawn in those spots.
Well, but, I just hope everybody has bad eyesight, you know. Tell me, what is your basic lawn grass?
Well, Bermuda, most of it, I believe, is Bermuda. It's not St. Augustine, that I know.
Okay.
But particularly, we have a sidewalk that bisects our front yard from the street to our front door. My neighbor has zoysia on the one side, and the grass over there that gets lots of sun and all that, lovely. But the grass that's under our oaks on the other side of the sidewalk, I see some erosion. It looks like, not terrible, but like water has run down there and maybe washed away.
Sure.
And then we live in Garden Ridge, and we have those big stones. There's one in the middle that's just, if there's a half inch of soil over it, that's a lot.
Right. So your yard, so you have a good deal of shade in the yard?
We do.
Okay, and here's the problem, is Bermuda is a full sun grass. If it were out in the sun, Bermuda will choke out everything except St. Augustine. St. Augustine is the toughest grass out there, and it will choke out everything. But Bermuda in the sun is great. Bermuda in the shade is always going to have an issue. So you can kill every weed out there, but what is happening is that you've got all these weeds that say, hey, I'm happy in the shade. Look at this bare ground. I think I'm going to move in. And so you can treat, and you'll kill what's there, and it'll come right back, and you'll kill it again, and it'll come right back, and it gets very, very frustrating. So, you know, the choice is, do you really want grass? Would you be happier with a ground cover, like Asiatic jasmine or something like that, that will do in the shade? If you say, I really want to have grass out there, and by the way, you could go with a look-alike, like dwarf monkey grass or something like that, at least in limited areas. But if you really want to have grass, at some point, you are going to replace it with a shade-tolerant St. Augustine grass, such as Del Mar or Palmetto. Now, it doesn't have to be done all at once. I mean, if it's in the budget and somebody's got the energy to do it, there are folks out there who would just, you know, totally resod the lawn, and your St. Augustine will do much, much better in the shade than the Bermuda ever dreamed of. If it were me doing it, and if I had the water, because St. Augustine does require watering. Bermuda, if you don't water it, it turns brown, but it doesn't die. St. Augustine, if you don't water it, it dies. So, if I had the water to do it, I'd just start taking little plugs of it, putting it here and there, and just water and fertilize and letting it choke out the unhealthy Bermuda and choke out all the weeds. And that's the, you know, that's the best long-term solution. Now, I personally think most people have too much grass in their yards. I think there's so many beautiful things that grow in the shade, from, you know, holly fern to this time of year. The cyclamen are so colorful, and we've got a list we give people free of charge. It probably has 50 different plants that are happier in the shade out there. Now, if you're in Garden Ridge, in the front yard, do you have deer issues?
We have deer. Okay. They don't give us any issues, but we may not have provided them issues.
Well, then you haven't, you just haven't planted the plants that they would like to die
on.
So, if you decide to put in some shade tolerant plants, you'll have to be conscious of which things the deer are most likely to leave alone. But they're not grass eaters. I mean, axes are grass eaters. They'll tear up your grass, but whitetails, which is what, you know, the majority of the deer in the hill country at this point, they're browsers. They eat twigs and actually some of the weeds and things. They don't go after lawn grass, so they're not going to be an issue there. But if you decide to go with beds and reduce the amount of grass, then you have to be careful to plant things that will be will tolerate some munching by the deer occasionally, or else that the deer just don't like. But it will be a longer process, but it will be a total failure if you try to, you know, improve what's there, because the Bermuda's simply not going to be happy unless you decide to cut down the oaks, and I don't think that's going to happen.
No. All right, and no, because they are absolutely lovely.
Oh, I'm sure.
Which does lead into my second question, which the woman before, we talked about oaks, and so I did write down the information for David Vaughn and all.
Uh-huh.
But how do I know when my oaks need to be trimmed?
They never need to be trimmed. They need to be trimmed if you have like a major break somewhere. Sometimes if they make very narrow angles, they may need to be cabled or braced to prevent storm damage. But the only reason you trim an oak is because you want it to look different. Or, you know, you drive around South Texas, you see these gorgeous huge oak trees with limbs that are down touching the ground. That's the way Mother Nature intended those trees to grow, because the closer the limbs are to the ground, the more they shade the roots, the cooler the soil is, the healthier the tree is going to be. So trimming oak trees is strictly to please Susan, and has nothing at all to do with when the tree needs to be pruned. I can't really think, and again, if a tree got struck by lightning and you had some damage to it that was in danger of falling on the home, or if there were some issue with the tree that were posing a physical threat, yes, you would need to prune. But most of the time, you just have these folks that all they want to do is take your money and, tell you they're going to make your trees look prettier. But live oaks do not need to be pruned. Now, if you have them rubbing on your house or ruining your roof or soffits or something like that, yeah, I definitely would do some pruning then. But don't fall for this gimmick that, we're gonna trim your oaks because they need to be trimmed. Simply not the truth.
Oh, well, that is wonderful information. Because they are absolutely fabulous and huge, but two of them are very close to our house. I mean, their limbs at the outermost are really close to our roof.
You may want to trim those. I wouldn't do it excessively because they're lowering your energy bills in the summer months. But if they're to the point that they're rubbing on things, in that case, some trimming would be in order, and you very definitely need to seal every wound that's made on the trees. But these folks that want to come in and charge you huge amounts of money to go through and thin out your trees and things like that, they're doing more harm than they are good, so don't fall for that. I mean, if you have every oak tree as it really matures, because the outer part of the canopy gets thicker and thicker, it's going to shade out the sunlight getting to the inside of the tree, and some of those interior limbs are going to die. If you want to trim those out, that's just fine. But again, that's kind of like trimming your hair or your fingernails. The tree doesn't know one way or the other. And believe me, when you travel the hill country in South Texas and see these majestic trees just out away from civilization, so to speak, somehow they manage to make big, giant, beautiful trees without anybody getting in there and trimming them every couple of years and taking the landowner's money. So, there may indeed come a time when, like I say, a tree's rubbing on your house, or when one reason or another it has a potential to cause damage. Yeah, in that case, you might need to do a little bit of trimming, but this business of going in and for artistic reasons is BS.
Oh, perfect. That's great. okay, and my final question is, we have some bougainvillea in pots.
Mm-hmm.
Can I put it in the ground?
I wouldn't do it this time of year because it will have very little time to become established and would be more susceptible to cold damage. You can put it in the ground, and it's a gamble. Bougainvilleas don't like temperatures below 32 degrees, and bougainvilleas frequently die if the temperatures get below 15 or 20 degrees. And so it definitely, you'll be out covering when the time comes, we get some really cold weather. Might not be this winter, might not be next year. We have had, much warmer winters the past 3 or 4 years, with one or two really cold periods interspersed. So if you want to put them in the ground, I would do it in the spring so that they will be as well established as possible before next winter comes around. But, it's always a little bit of a gamble because we never know. I've lived here long enough to have seen some really cold winters. I can only remember, we've had our nursery here for 39 years. I can only remember 2 years in 39 years that I've actually seen established bougainvilleas in the ground fully killed. But I can tell you lots of winters when they've been frozen way, way back to the point that it took them a while to come out. So the choice is yours. You're in Garden Ridge, so you're a little colder than San Antonio. I'll just tell you, in Bernie, outside Bernie where I live, I would not put bougainvilleas in the ground.
Okay, because I have them in big pots now, but then when I think I'll be taking them and my perennial hibiscus in. But
perennial hibiscus probably don't need to. Tropical hibiscus will have to come in. If the temperature is going to be significantly below freezing, you ought to try to get those bougainvilleas in.
And by in, do we mean like in watching TV with us or in the garage?
How cold is it going to get? If it's going to get, say, down to 20, the garage is probably fine. If it's going to get down to 10 degrees, I hope they enjoy whatever you watch on TV.
Okay. And then, but the perennial hibiscus, can I plant it in the ground next spring? Or should stay in its big pot?
It's perennial hibiscus. Any plant can suffer if the pot freezes all the way through. But there are two different kinds of really perennial hibiscus. One of them is a woody shrub that we call an althea. They'll go to 10 below zero without damage. And then we have the ones that freeze down but come right back out, like the mallows and the lunas and the Texas star and the moy grande and, a lot of these. And it's perfectly normal for them to freeze down and come back out. And, first year we had the nursery, it went to about 5 degrees, and we had them in pots, and they obviously froze, and they came back out. Oak trees died in pots that year, and the perennial hibiscus came right back out. So they're only going to need protection in an extraordinarily severe winter, but do expect that they will get some damage in an average winter.
Okay.
And by damage, I mean just freezing down, but then they come right back out.
Okay, perfect. Great. Well, that's a lot of great information for me to work with today.
Well, I'm so glad you got through this morning. I look forward to talking again sometime. Thank you, Susan.
All right. Thank you.
Certainly. Bye. All right. Got to get a break in here, and we'll be right back to the phone calls. And, You know, talking about all this potential cold weather leads in perfectly to me telling you about the Freeze Miser. And this is truly one of the neatest devices I have ever seen. I was very skeptical when I first heard about it, and then I saw it and understood the workings of it. And I put them on my faucets last year, and I absolutely love them. Freeze Miser is a simple device. It has no batteries. It has no wires. It doesn't work on electricity at all. It works on some physics and some good chemistry, and it protects your hydrants from freezing. How many times have you had to go out and drip the hydrants? And have you ever had a hydrant break? I mean, weird things happen in town. I think of years living in town. You went out and dripped the hydrants, and then everybody else in town dripped theirs. The water pressure went down, and your hydrants froze anyway. Well, the Freeze Miser takes all the guesswork out of it. It knows, and I'll just leave it at that. It knows when the temperature inside the hydrant drops below 40 degrees. Has nothing to do with air temperature. But when there's a danger that the water inside the hydrant would freeze, it automatically begins dripping very slowly. Now, if you happen to be up north where they've used these things for years and it's going to get to 20 below zero, the colder it gets, the more it will drip to prevent damage. And as soon as it warms up, stops dripping. You don't have to do a thing. It takes care of itself. And I put mine on with Y connectors on my exposed hydrant so that I can leave my hose attached on one side and use it when I need to. But when it gets really cold, well, the other side, the Freeze Miser drips and protects that hydrant. It's just a neat device. I used them all last winter. I will be using them this winter, and I'm recommending them to all my friends. You know, you'll find them at good nurseries around. You'll find them at good hardware stores around. It's Freeze, F-R-E-E-Z-E, Freeze Miser, M-I-S-E-R. Oh, what a pretty day it is out there, and such a great day for gardening, and it's gonna change, but gonna be a little chillier next week. Maybe just we're gonna have a chance of a good rain as well. So that would certainly be welcome. Right now we're just talking gardening. Glenn is up next, and it'll be Dolores and Danny. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, sir. Good morning, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Just sitting here looking out at a fall day, and seems like we've either been at summer or approaching winter, but this is just one of those in-between days that's just about as nice as it can be.
Amen. I'm sitting out on my back patio and watching, feeding the birds and watching nature. My question is, I need an organic treatment for termites. Okay. Do you have any recommendations?
Absolutely, depending on where the termites are. Are they in the fence? Are they in your home? If they're in your home, are they on an exterior wall?
Yes.
Where? Okay. Here's the problem with termites, and that when home builders, I'd say 98% of the home builders, when they pour a slab, they leave holes in the slab. They call the penetrations, and this is where they, you know, bring the pipes and sometimes wiring and things like that through. And there are a handful of good home builders that put a stainless steel mesh down there so nothing can get through it. But if you get a colony of termites, because termites, the termites we have in this area, the great majority of them, their colony is in the soil, and then they come up into the wooden part of your home to feed. And if you've got termites way down in the middle of your slab coming up through those holes in the slab to feed on things, I'm afraid it's a job for a professional. It's not a do-it-yourself job. But if you have them on the perimeter of your home, or if you have them in a wooden fence or a shop or something like that, beneficial nematodes will kill them very effectively. To a nematode, they're just a big ant. They're an opportunity for the nematode to parasitize them, reproduce in them, and kill them in the process. So if you have the little tunnels on, or the little kind of dirt tunnels they build on the outside, I would begin by soaking that area very thoroughly with one of the beneficial nematodes that controls termites, and in most cases that's going to take care of the problem. Now, if that colony is way up underneath the slab, where the termite or where the nematodes can't get to them, well, then that's when you have to, you know, resort to having somebody that has the equipment to get under, and they there's some much more, user-friendly product, so to speak. They're not the really bad stuff that they used to put out for termites. But where they're in the fence out in the yard, where they're, you know, in the wall of your shop, when they're right on the perimeter, on the periphery, on the perimeter of your home, beneficial nematodes will take care of just fine. You can also use, if you know exactly where they are, and I've done this a time or two. I had some come up underneath the brick floor I put in my greenhouse, and I just used orange oil and water and soaked it down through the brick, and I wiped them out with the first treatment there. But in general, I recommend using the beneficial nematodes. Now, recognize that. Go ahead.
These are appearing beam houses, and a shop that had some wood that was lifted off the ground, by some blocks or whatever else. The termites got into some paneling we had there, but they're starting to get into the shop, which is up on Pier and Beam, and the house itself, the exterior. We know that the main beam on the exterior is eaten up, but we want to try and get them killed off. I imagine they're probably mostly all over the yard, too. I know there's subterranean termites, but do you think just one of the blue sponges, those BT sponges will take care of it?
Yeah, it's not BT, but the blue sponges. Here's the problem where you're actually under a structure. The soil has to be moist for the nematodes to be able to move through and get to the termites. So it would be an area that you can, get the soil pretty wet for them to be able to effectively go after that. Now, if it's an area and, it's way under a Pier and Beam home or something like that, you could try saturating the soil with either a rosemary oil-based product or an orange oil-based product, and that will certainly kill them. It's certainly not as easy as it is to use, but unfortunately, beneficial nematodes don't work in super dry soil. They work great in the yard, and they work great, in any area that you can wet it thoroughly before you put them out. But you're going to have to make the judgment call on your own situation whether you'd be able to do that.
No problem. We do have access to the exterior of the house. I mean, worst case scenario, we can put a drip hose around the exterior for a while, let it run, then come in with the blue sponge and saturate it.
Yeah, and as long as there's moisture where the nematodes can get through to the termite colony, they'll wipe them out 100%.
Do you know about how long it might take?
Two or three days.
Fantastic.
Yeah, they move pretty quickly. But understand now, if that main colony is way back under the house where you can't get the soil moist, you're probably going to have some professional help on that one.
We can get underneath the house. That's not an issue.
Very fantastic. Good. And do keep in mind, too, that out in the yard, termites are totally normal. If we didn't have termites, the earth would probably be 40 miles deep in dead wood. So I don't worry about them. When I see them out in the yard, when I'm walking around my ranch and I kick over an old stump and it's full of termites, hey, that's Mother Nature at work. They're only a problem when they get into our buildings, our structures where we don't want them. So it's not something I recommend, and I certainly... There are pest control companies out there that would make you think if you had a piece of board lying out in the yard and turned it over and there were termites and they need to come to a $1,000 treatment. No, it is perfectly normal to have some termites in the yard, but if they start causing damage to fences and structures, that's when we need to take action to get rid of them.
Fantastic, sir. Your knowledge is unbelievable. I wish I had one-third of it.
Well, I've been doing it a few years, and I've had some wonderful mentors over the years. So I've been a very blessed man in that regard, so I just enjoy sharing it with people. And you get out and have a great weekend and go kill some termites.
Thank you, sir, for your time. Have a blessed day.
Thank you, Glenn. You too. Bye. All right, let me get my last break of the hour out of the way here. We'll talk to Dolores and move down the list from there. I get to talk about Sam Sitterly and Green Grow Organic. Sam's one of those people I love talking about, kind of like my arborist friend David Vaughn, because they always do it right. They always do it naturally. They stay away from the toxic products, but they do things that work. Sam has a business where he takes care of things like fertilizing, compost tea application, insect control, disease control, always with organic and natural products. But unlike the guys in the white trucks that are spraying some pretty toxic stuff and tying you to a to a long-term contract, with Sam, no long-term contracts. He's there to do the work that you need help with, and without long-term contracts. But with 30 years of knowledge backing him up, he knows how to get the job done, and he knows how to help you have the most beautiful landscape that is in the neighborhood. And it just, you know, it's nice doing business with good people. And I consider Sam Sitterly to be good people, and he's helped so many people in this area with problems with their yards. Once again, no long-term contracts, always safe, natural, organic products. And it's real easy. Check them out online at Green Grow, spelled out G-R-O-W, greengroworganics.com. If you like what you see, call him, set up a no-cost, no-obligation appointment. He will look over the landscape with you, following all COVID guidelines, and tell you what he sees that needs to be improved or could be improved, and you decide how much of the work you want to do, how much you want him to do, and you move forward from there. It's Green Grow Organics. He's Sam Sitterly, and he's been doing this for about 30 years. Check out online when you're ready to give him a call. I believe it's 732-8500, 210 area code, but check him out. Good guy that'll solve a lot of problems for you. Green Grow Organics. All right. Well, let's see here. It looks like we are going to talk to Dolores and Glenn, and actually Dolores and Bob and Robin. Do we still have Glenn on there? No, we just talked to Glenn. That's right. That's right. Okay. It's going to be Dolores, Bob, and Robin, and Dolores is first. Good morning, Dolores.
Good morning, gardening guru.
How may I assist you in your quest for the answer to gardening life these days?
Oh, I can imagine you can do any of them. I have a Japanese oleander that was beautiful, full of leaves. You couldn't see through it. All of a sudden, it started dropping leaves, turning brown, and they fall off, or I pull them off, and the thing comes back to life. Okay. What's the matter with it?
Does the browning start at the tip of the leaves, and then pretty soon the whole leaf is brown and falling off?
Yes, sir.
Okay, it probably is this disease that has started hitting oleanders in about the past 5 years. It's called bacterial leaf scorch. And the so-called experts at the Extension Service will tell you there's no hope for it. Just pull it up and get rid of it and don't plant another one. We find that spraying with hydrogen peroxide, just get your good old grocery store hydrogen peroxide. Yeah, mix it about one part peroxide to two parts water. Spray it very thoroughly. Do that two or three times over the period of 2 or 3 months. And we've seen a lot of them, you know, totally cured. But if you want to look it up, the disease is called bacterial leaf scorch, but ignore the part that says you can't do anything about it.
Okay. It's coming back again now. It comes and goes.
Yep. But well, ultimately, if you don't do something, it will ultimately kill the plant. But it is a serious disease. But unlike the naysayers who say there's nothing you can do about it, those are the same people that you said you can't do anything about oak wilt, you can't do anything about some other problems that we found are quite curable. The best thing we found is simply hydrogen peroxide, 2-to-1 water to hydrogen peroxide. Spray it thoroughly, make 2 or 3 sprayings a couple of weeks apart, and I think you'll find your oleanders recover very well.
Wonderful. And this time of year, as it gets cooler, I can still do that?
Absolutely. You do it whenever. But I definitely would get it done, because the disease is serious enough that some of the big oleander growers across the country have stopped growing oleanders totally. Mm-hmm. I've gotten to where I think that they're pretty here and there, but I'd never tell somebody to plant a privacy hedge of them or something like that, because if you don't take care of them and they get this disease, they will die. But I still think they're great plants. I just don't tell people don't build your landscape around them. Just use them here and there where they'll add that color. And one of the few things the deer won't eat, the bugs won't bother very much. So I still like oleanders.
Okay. And also, now I have a live oak tree that's probably 8 to 10 feet tall, but it needs to be limbed up. You can't see the trunk, and I want it to make it. I was listening to you speak to the lady earlier about the Lord.
Yeah. Well, here's here's the thing. Don't skin it down to just the trunk, because everywhere you have green foliage up and down the trunk, it's helping the trunk to grow more quickly in diameter. When I have a young tree like that, every winter I go through and I cut all that little side growth that back to about 4 or 5 inches long. But I'm not going to take it all the way off until that trunk's about 6 inches in diameter. I'll end up with much weaker tree if I cut all those off. So don't let them make major limbs, but trim them back, but don't take them all the way off.
Okay, that'll work for me, because I want to see that trunk and see that it is making a tree.
It will. Be a little bit patient with it.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, here we are back to gardening once again. Now that you know that the most important things happening in the world are actually probably happening right in your own garden. So I hope you're going to get out and enjoy that today. We're going to talk to Bob and Robin and Roger starting things out. And first up is a man with a very good name. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Bob.
Yes, sir.
I have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
I got given about two live oak and two red oak trees that have been in a 1 gallon container for about a year. The nursery was going out of business, and they were given to a friend of mine, and they were passed over to me.
Okay.
When I take them out of there and put them in the ground, what do I need to do to the root system? Because it's got to be root bound like there ain't no tomorrow.
Well, the thing I'm most concerned about are what we call circling or girdling roots. So on a tree like that, I'm going to take my pruning shears, and I'm just going to go straight down one side of the root ball, snip, snip, snip. You will cut a bunch of roots. Some of them may be fair size, but in the long term, you're saving the tree's life. And you picked exactly the right time of year to do it. Going into fall and winter months, this is the time we can do a little root pruning where we need to. So I just go down one side of that root ball. The roots that are going to potentially cause problems, they're going to be the ones that are right at the outer edge of that root ball. You don't have to worry about digging down deeply into it. Just go down, going maybe a quarter of an inch into the ball, and just cut every root that you coming straight down one side, and you'll be good to go.
Okay. My second question is, I've got a little bit of Medina that I didn't use on my yard. Should I mix that a little bit with the dirt that I dig up and when I plant this?
It's a fine idea. There's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. I think whether you mix it with the dirt or whether you just sprinkle some of it in the bottom of the hole, it's we're talking a dry growing green product, I imagine, and it will never burn. It never causes any problems. So if you can mix some of it with the soil that goes back into the hole, or if you simply want to, put some of it in the bottom of the hole, either way, the trees will thank you.
Okay, well, yeah, that's why I use the organic stuff, is because I'm out in the country and I live on a water well, so we don't use it as dry as it is. You know how that is. You live out.
I live on a shallow water well. My water well is only about 100 feet deep, and I have a old hand dug well not too far from the house. It's only about 35 feet deep, so I know about protecting our water. Believe me, for many different reasons.
I'm the same way. Mine's 120, and I got an old hand dug there. By here, that's probably about 30 or 40 also. I got one more question for you right quick. I would like to grow a Myers lemon. I know that I've got to try and protect it. I've got an old cattle trough, or old water trough for cattle, that's got holes in it. I would like to plant it in that right outside my garden. How big do they get?
Well, that's a great question. Most of the Myers lemons that you're going to buy are grafted on either sour orange rootstock or something called carrizo rootstock, and they're going to grow about 15, 18 feet tall and maybe 10 feet wide. Occasionally, you will see one grown from a cutting that is more likely to make a bush than a tree, and it's not going to get probably more than 10 feet tall, but it's going to be very bushy. And occasionally, you will see what people will call a dwarf Meyer lemon. And in this case, it's simply a Meyer's lemon that's been grafted onto a special rootstock, happens to be called Flying Dragon, that makes for, it keeps the tree small, but still gives you the big lemon. So if you're looking at one that's grafted on Flying Dragon, if you're looking on a cutting grown one, probably not going to get much over 10 feet tall. If it's on another rootstock, it's probably going to get somewhere around 15 feet tall.
Okay, well, I'm just thinking that I'm probably going to have to protect it at one time or another from freezes. And I would do that with a, you know, a PVC type tarp type deal, so that I'm not laying something right on it. So that Flying Dragon is probably pretty much what I'm looking for.
Well, if you're going to go out and get one, it's certainly the one that I would be buying. What area are you in, Bob?
I'm about halfway between Houston and San Antonio, and a little bit south of Interstate 10.
Yeah, you're not gonna. I'm a little worried that you might have been up in the Hill Country or Fredericksburg or somewhere like that. You're not gonna have to protect that tree often. I bet you it's not more than, you know, you may have winters when you don't have to protect it at all, because Meyer's lemons can go down into the upper 20s. They can probably go as low as 26. And as long as it doesn't stay there for a long period of time, that's not an issue to them. So, you're probably not going to see more than two or three times a year, and you may see many years when you don't have to protect it at all. So you're in a good area to grow a Meyer's lemon.
Well, that's a good thing. Well, thank you, sir. That's all I've got for right now, and I sure appreciate it.
You get out and enjoy your Sunday, Bob. We'll talk again, and I'll move on next and talk to Robin. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Two questions. I have a lantana that when the flowers are finished, they're turning black. And I see none of the little green seed bulbs forming at all.
Right.
Just these black flowers.
Okay.
And I wonder what's going on.
Well, I would imagine, first of all, that you probably have, excuse me, a very common insect on there called the lace bug, that it'll make the flower buds turn black, and it will sometimes create kind of a silvery sheen to the foliage, and the plant just won't look as healthy. Now, probably 90% of the lantanas that are propagated these days don't make a lot of seed. That's one of the great strides forward. New Gold was the first one, but nowadays we've got, you know, 50 varieties that don't make much seed because they just bloom almost all the time. Has this plant made seed before? Is this the first year it hasn't made seed? Or has it ever made a bunch of seeds?
We've had a lot of problems with it. It had lace bug really bad last year, and we treated it, and we thought it, and the leaves look okay right now, but I did not know that they had varieties that didn't make that little seed pod now. I didn't.
Yeah, probably 90, maybe as much as 98% of them are ones that don't make much seed. If you're getting lace bug consistently, it tells me your lantana's a little stressed. You probably need to increase your fertilizing. You probably need to increase the frequency of watering. Everybody talks about how drought tolerant lantana is. But what they don't really say is, it'll survive a drought, but it won't look very good during a drought, and it will be much more susceptible to insect problems if you're letting it get too dry. So we're getting close to the time that it may freeze back for the winter anyway, but next season I would very definitely increase your fertilizing, increase your watering, and you probably never see a lace bug.
Okay, great. Thank you. And one more question. I have this terrible-looking fungus that's coming up. It looks like it's a brown, yucky-looking phallic symbol type of thing. It's terrible.
Well, I'm going to tell you what a lot of people call that. They call it dog vomit fungus because that's kind of what it looks like. But it's harmless. If you want to get rid of it, you can throw a little sulfur out. But it's actually in the group of plants we call slime molds, and as ugly and disgusting as they look, they don't really do much damage. The only way they really cause any damage is they'll sometimes make kind of a crust that keeps the water from getting into the soil very evenly. But they're a disgusting nuisance, but they're not really going to hurt your plants. So just wash them down with a hose, and if you want to sprinkle a little sulfur on them, they'll go away.
Okay, and I usually have to dig it up. It's almost like it has roots.
Well, it forms. Its body is called a mycelium, and it makes kind of root-like things. It may be called hyphae, but if you get it before it gets, you know, kind of that dead crusty point, it's a lot easier to get under control. And like I say, the only real damage, and you've seen this, is that it just makes such a crust that water just runs off rather than soaking through. So I wouldn't feel like you have to dig it out, but I would certainly break it up. I get in there with a spading fork or, you know, even a rake or something like that, and just in effect chop some holes down through it so the water can get through. It's a little unusual to have it when it's as dry as it is right now, but it's not anything that's going to take over the world and cause any huge problems to you.
Is that something you would put in a compost pile?
Wouldn't hurt anything. Wouldn't hurt anything at all.
Okay. But we don't know that it's particularly beneficial.
No, it's, I don't think it's, I mean, well, it'll break down and it will add some good nutrients to it. It's not in the group that I would call, you know, a beneficial organism, but neither is it pathogenic. It's not disease causing. So, it's something to be dealt with, but nothing to get panicked over.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you so much for all you do. Have a wonderful day.
You do the same, Robin, and I sure appreciate the call this morning. All right, I guess better do a quick break here. Roger will be up next when we get through with his little break, but I get to talk to you about the Cedar Eater of Texas. And once again, I just love talking about good people, and have known Stan Hagener and the folks at the Cedar Eater for a lot of years. I've known so many people that have used their services, and I see places all the time where I live in the Hill Country where literally one day I'm driving by a property that is just choked with second growth ash juniper, and I go by there a day later and hey, the land's opened up. There's a nice layer of mulch on the ground. All the oaks are out there, the escarpment cherries, all the native trees are saying, oh, thank you so much. And it's truly amazing how much area they can cover really in a single day, and they do it so environmentally friendly. They go through and cut the cedar off at ground level, the machine does, and then grinds it into a nice mulch all in one operation. They can do acres and acres in a single day. If you have a lot of tight growth around the beneficial trees, they'll send in a hand clearing crew that will cut those cedars, drag them out in the open where the machine can grind them into mulch too. If you're looking to restore good health to your land, if you're looking to take care of probably the biggest problem we have in the Hill Country, well, you need to call the Cedar Eater of Texas. 210-745-2743. I'll mention once again, too, if you're down in South Texas wanting to clear those cinderas, they can do miles and miles in just one day. 210-745-2743 for the Cedar Eater of Texas. All right. Looks like we're going to talk to Roger and Chris and Charles, and Roger's up first. Good morning, Roger.
Yes. Good morning, Bob. Good to talk
good morning.
With you. I just first want to let you know how much we appreciate you giving up your Sunday mornings for us. I appreciate that.
Well, it's my pleasure, and no offense to my good friends back at the radio station, but I kind of enjoy, and, you know, the dogs you hear barking in the background, and occasionally the cattle have something to say. I'm sitting here looking out the window of our nursery at just a beautiful, beautiful setting, so it's not a bad way to spend a Sunday morning. I will admit I'd rather be fishing somewhere with my fly rod in the high country, but that country's getting too cold now, so I'm glad to be here for you, but I appreciate the compliment.
Well, that's America. That's America.
Yes,
I'm calling on behalf of my wife. I get a couple questions, well, probably three. Snails. We just have an abundance of snails. We've tried your beer, and that doesn't work, and they seem to just flourish. What can we do to get rid of them?
Well, describe the snails to me. Do they look kind of like an ice cream cone? Do they have a drawn-out spiral shell? Or are they more kind of a big, round, you know, a great big snail? What does the shell look like?
It's a small, round shell. It's not a large one. Now, my grandson, he's got huge ones. But
yeah.
Ours
now,
is
yours round and flat, or is it kind of, would it remind you of an ice cream cone turned on side?
No, it's round and flat.
Okay. Well, those are ones we need to get rid of. The ice cream cone looking ones, those are actually beneficial and they do very little damage to your plants. They're called the collet scales, snails, but what you're looking at are called bush snails, and they are damaging. And there is a non-toxic bait that you can put out for them, and it's called Sluggo. I like the one called Sluggo Plus because they've had something to it that kills pill bugs as well. But Sluggo Plus, it's a granule. You sprinkle it around. It's harmless to people and pets, but it is really good against all kinds of damaging snails.
Sounds good. Next question. We were given 4 chickens, and we retired, so we're enjoying them. Matt, my wife is enjoying them more than I am. But anyway, for a bedding, she's been using pine shavings. She likes to use the manure in the garden, but wondering if that is the best bedding because she puts that in the garden.
You know, about 11 o'clock, the best veterinarian I have ever known in my life is going to be sitting here next to me. And he lives right on the edge of Alamo Heights and has a backyard full of chickens, too. So let me ask Dan. I have always heard that cedar shavings were good as bedding. But let me ask the man who would be the real expert on there. It's fine for the garden. I mean, I can't tell you whether it's the best bedding for the chickens, but it's a great way to kind of allow that that manure to break down a bit. Chicken manure is very hot. You want it to be aged a little bit and mixed in with some of that pine bedding is a great way to go. But let me ask Dan if there's a better material to use for chickens.
Okay, so pine shavings is fine for the garden. It takes a while to break down, but we just want to make sure of that.
Well, see, here's the thing, and is that if you're just using pine shavings, I would tell you that you need to put in some extra fertilizer because they'll steal a little bit of nutrient in the process of breaking down. But voila, you've already mixed a ton of fertilizer in with those pine shavings in the form of the droppings the chickens leave behind. So it's kind of an ideal garden product.
Okay.
I think you're fortunate to have it, and I think you'll probably grow an even better garden because of it. So, I don't see any issues there at all.
Okay, one other question. Well, two other, but I'll make them short. We have the white flies in her greenhouse last year. They just got on everything. Now, we used a dormant oil when I fooled around with a garden. And that seemed to knock them down for a while, but and now they're out in the garden in the broccoli and cabbage. What can we use to get rid of them little white flies?
I use a product called Spinosad Soap. And dormant oil, the problem with that is it'll burn a lot of different things if it's not really cold when you put it out. The Spinosad soap is much easier to use. It's totally safe for you, and it's effective against aphids and whitefly, and even works against caterpillars, although it has to come in contact. So for the garden, I would suggest getting it's just called Spinosad soap. And it'll do a very good job at knocking them down. In your greenhouse, I'm going to tell you, you need to either put a fan in, or if you already have a fan, you need to put a bigger fan in, because if you keep lots of air moving around in that greenhouse, you're not likely to have whitefly. But if it gets, if there's sort of stagnant air in there, man, the whiteflies will drive you crazy. So you can probably prevent the problem in the greenhouse with a little more air movement, but out in the garden, I'd be going with Spinosad soap.
Okay, it has fans in it, so we'll make sure they run. One last question. I'm a Yankee that moved down here 15 years ago, and I know just about all of the trees in the Adirondacks, but my wife picked up some acorns yesterday at a place that was with my daughter, and they look like they came from the Garden of Eden. What kind of tree is it that grows those big acorns?
It's most likely, in this area, it's most likely a bur oak. Very good tree, long-lived tree, resistant to oak wilt. There now, we also, if you get away from San Antonio, you'll see some post oaks and blackjack oaks that are really more of the wimp of the tree family, and they have some issues. But if you're finding those in the San Antonio area, they're almost certainly a bur oak, and they are an excellent tree. If you decide to plant and grow any of these, be sure and put some chicken wire or something over the pots, because the cute little bushy-tailed tree rat that people call a squirrel, they will dig that up and think they've just found Thanksgiving dinner. And so if you're starting some in pots, be sure you put something over them so the squirrels can't get to them. Or I laugh because my business partner planted some many years ago before she was even my business partner. And the squirrels cleaned out about a dozen pots, stole every acre in one night, so or in one day. So do be aware that they would like to have those for dinner. But no, they're a great tree. I like seeing a lot of diversity in the canopy. I'd never fill up a yard with bur oaks, but I planted two of them recently in my yard, and I'll probably plant another couple of them because I have a very large yard, and I think they're an excellent tree.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Bob, for your time, and we are much appreciated.
Well, it's my pleasure, Roger. Appreciate the call. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. All right. Let's go ahead and take one more call. I believe that would be Chris would be up next. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning, Bob. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fantastic. How about you?
Doing great. Just heading back from a little fishing trip. I heard you mention fishing earlier. So,
where'd you go?
We were down in Bluffs Landing, so down in Corpus. So just headed back
okay.
up to Old Verde.
Very good.
Yep. Well, I just had a quick question on a live oak. About 3 weeks ago, every leaf in a span of maybe 24 to 48 hours just turned brown. And a lot of them have fallen. They're not really sticking to the branch or anything, but it's what's concerning to say the least. The other live oaks around it are perfectly fine. They got all their leaves still, so I didn't know if there was anything to be concerned about.
Is this an established tree? Is this a newly planted tree?
No, sir. It's probably at least 20 years old.
Okay. Well, I would definitely be concerned. That's not oak wilt. Oak wilt is a much slower process. It's not a good sign. Is it a very big tree? Is it taller than the other trees in the area? Is there anything distinctive about this tree?
No, and it kind of hangs around under the canopy of a few other live oak trees.
Okay.
So I didn't know if that might be a concern.
Well, if you told me it was a bigger tree, I'd tell you it could have been a lightning strike, because I've seen a lightning strike, you know, do that to a tree. Sometimes kills a tree, sometimes it comes back out. A lot of oaks are dropping a lot of leaves prematurely this year, and my arborist friends tell me always be concerned with what's on the tree, not what's on the ground. But if this tree has lost every leaf, something is very definitely happening that's not good with the tree. But it doesn't sound like oak wilt. It doesn't sound like anything that would be spreading from one tree to another. It sounds more like something that's probably been building up for a while, some sort of damage to the tree, possibly girdling by a porcupine or something like that, that's just, you know, in effect, finally caught up with the tree. So there's nothing really in particular I would tell you to do except examine it very closely, especially down toward the base. And have you tried bending the limbs? Do they have any green to them,
did,
or are they dry and brittle at this point?
I did. They're still pretty green. They're okay. And I've noticed nothing around the flare, so I didn't mulch. They get ample water. You know, I wouldn't say they're overwatered. So, but they get ample. I didn't mulch this year. They're not, you know, the flare is perfectly fine. I've had issues with, we had to have a lace bark elm removed. That was an odd tree to have in that backyard, but it grew really well for a period of time, but then it just died almost instantaneously. Just that, I guess it was 2 years ago after we got a really hard freeze late in the year or earlier on in the in the late in the winter. So, and all the leaves fell off, and I figured it'd come back, but it didn't come back. But it had a fair amount of root girdling on it. There's some mushrooms that are growing out within the tree line, you know, between the trunk and the tree line. So I'm not sure if that might, you know, be a symptom of an issue. So as far
that would be an after the fact thing, because the mushrooms are just the fruiting body of the little beneficial fungus that destroys dead roots, but they're not something that hurts the tree, you know, in advance, so to speak. The one other place that I have seen that happen to a tree was somewhere where someone, without knowing it, had a leak in their gas line. And, you know, I don't know, in this case, these were people had a, you know, natural gas yard light, and they got a leak in that line and had a couple of trees where it was leaking right around the base of the tree. The tree just folded up and died almost overnight. So that's, you know, not a likely thing, but if you have natural gas, if you have that in the area, you might definitely have that line looked at. But beyond that, it doesn't sound like a tree. It doesn't sound like a disease.
No, it was. I mean, to have the other live oak trees that are much more established, you know, be perfectly fine. And there's one next to it that's not really that much more established. It's, you know, 3-4 feet away. It be okay. It's just a really interesting situation. I don't know if there's an arborist in particular in San Antonio that you'd recommend, or somebody that you can
absolutely
have come out.
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, I've already given out his name and number once this morning. But the guy that I trust is a fellow named David Vaughn. And he used to work for my friends at Edder Tree Care. And I think when he turned 70, he said, I don't have to work this hard. So he does strictly consulting. But he's the guy that teaches the courses that other arborists have to take if they want to become certified arborist, and just an incredibly nice guy and a good fisherman too. So you probably, although he's more freshwater than saltwater, but if you want to give David a call, I know he'd be happy to talk to you. And his number is you have somebody. I don't want you to be trying to write while you're driving.
Yes, sir. Somebody next to me, phone in hand.
Okay. All right. Well, area code 210, phone number is 788-4986. That's 788-4986, area code 210. And you guys can talk fishing and talk trees.
There you go. Well, I'd love to have him out and just take a look or give me some guidance on who I might be able to talk to, because I would really not like to, or not prefer not to remove this tree. So,
well, again, he doesn't do the removal, so the only thing he has to sell you is knowledge. So he's not going to talk you into something that you don't need. And like I say, he's a guy I trust. He's a guy I call if I ever have a question or a problem. So tell him I said hello.
I will do. Thank you very much, Bob. As I'll echo the previous caller, I really appreciate what you do, and appreciate you taking time out of your Sunday to do this.
Well, as I said earlier, I'd rather be fishing, but this would be the second most enjoyable thing, so I'm happy to be here for you. You get out and have a good weekend, Chris, and tight lines to you, and we'll talk again. Let me get a break out of the way here, and we'll be right back. We'll start with Charles when we come back, and I get to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center, and Fanix is just doing all sorts of fun things like they always do. You know, they're more than a nursery now. They're carrying the Traeger pellet grills and all the accessories. They're carrying the Eco battery-powered equipment nowadays. They are so well-stocked on trees, too. CPS Energy has that green shade rebate program going on where plant the trees in a proper area around your home. CPS Energy will give you $50 credit per tree up to, I think, a maximum of 7 trees, something like that. But anyway, they're practically buying the trees for you. And Fanix just wants you to know that they are well-stocked on trees and that comply very much. They have a list of trees you need to choose among, but they are certainly well stocked, and there are lots of different trees to choose from. They also want to remind you that they have the saws coupon plants, and they have, oh gosh, pop-up greenhouses to help you get into the winter months when you're going to have to cover some things occasionally. Fanix is ready for the season, and they're ready for you to come see them. They're open 7 days a week. They're located over on Home Green Road, right where they've been for over 80 years, fully stocked with organic gardening supplies, fertilizer and mulch and compost. Like I say, after 80 years, you know they're good people doing a good job at Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. All right, on this beautiful Saturday morning, it's time now to visit with Charles. Good morning, Charles. Hi, Charles.
I have four questions. Can you hear me?
Just fine.
I have four questions about pecan trees. You mentioned yesterday that you were growing some pecan trees on your property. How many pecan trees do you have? What varieties of pecan trees do you have? Which varieties produce the most nuts? And what is the brand name of any fertilizer you use on them?
Okay. Well, I probably have maybe 40 or 50 pecan trees on my property, but I did not plant a single one of them. You know, my property's been in the family for, since the late 1800s, and some of them are grafted trees, some of them are native trees. So I will share with you what I feel are the best trees that I have helped friends with. But the trees that are on my property were planted long before I was alive for the most part, and most of them are the native trees. A few of them are grafted, and I think there probably some of them are the old Stewart, and there are some better trees out there now. But I mean on the market now, but I really, it's not like a pecan orchard that I planted myself. But if I were planting today, I can tell you that the commercial orchard people plant usually at least half their orchards in a variety called desirable, because desirable is one of the most prolific and most dependable producers out there. The desirable is an excellent variety of pecan. Like everything else, it does have one negative quality, and that is the wood's a little brittle, and some years it'll get so loaded up with pecans, I've seen, you know, good-sized limbs just break. But where you're looking for a really productive pecan tree, like I say, most commercial growers plant at least half of their pecan groves with desirable. Other very good varieties. Mohawk is a tree that doesn't get just huge, which makes it more suitable for an in-town size yard. So many pecan trees, I mean, one tree would just dominate the entire property. Mohawk is an excellent paper shell pecan that produces very well, that doesn't get just, you know, oversized. There's a variety called Sioux, S-I-O-U-X, like the Indian tribe. Sioux is a very good variety of pecan. Choctaw, C-H-O-C-T-A-W, I believe is the correct spelling on it, is also a very good pecan tree. I can't say all of the pecan varieties with the Indian names are good, because there are a couple of them, like Wichita, that are a little more susceptible to a disease called pecan scab fungus. But Mohawk, Choctaw, Cheyenne, Sioux, those are all very good varieties, dependable producers, and thin shell pecans. And I would be happy, if I were planting more pecan trees, I would be happy with any of those. But I've got pecan trees that are probably the diameter on those trunks is 4 feet across. So they're trees that were around a long time before I came along.
What do you fertilize them?
You know, I occasionally have fertilized this field, and they benefit from it. I like, you know, the same basic growing green fertilizer that Medina makes. I don't think you can find a better fertilizer. Guys that are into the synthetic chemical fertilizers, they're always running into zinc deficiencies and having to provide extra zinc for the trees. But I've never had that issue. You know, I think something like Medina's Growing Green, or for that matter, Nature's Creation's got one they call Premium Lawn Food. Both of those are fortified with extra iron and zinc and basically everything a pecan tree would need. They are non-burning. They don't have to be watered in. So those are what I use pretty much across the board, not just around the pecans, but, you know, I have peaches and plums and a few other trees as well. And that's my general go-to fertilizer.
Okay, one more question. Do you have any persimmon plants growing on your property?
Well, yes and no. There are two trees that are commonly called persimmons. We have a native persimmon that produces a relatively small blackish fruit. Makes pretty good wine. Some people make jelly out of it. But it's they can be invasive. They can be a bit of a nuisance. The second general type of persimmon would be what we call an Asian persimmon, or sometimes called a Korean persimmon. They are much larger. The fruit is, when it's ripe, it's just a golden yellow color. When it's green, it is highly astringent. It would pucker you unbelievably to try to eat them green. When they are ripe, they are one of the most delicious fruits you will ever eat. But I recommend virtually all of the Asian persimmons. They have names like Taninashi, Fuyu, F-U-Y-U is a really good one. There's one called Eureka, which is a really good one. Those Hachia is another very good one. Those are all excellent trees. They're a little more slow growing than something like a peach tree, but they will live for 100 years, and they very, very dependable producers. And like I say, you have to let the tree ripen. You have to let the fruit ripen. And when they do, sometimes they don't ripen until late enough in the fall that all the leaves have fallen off, and it just looks like little jack-o'-lanterns hanging all over the tree. But they are an excellent tree, and as long as you have reasonable soil, they do very well in this area. And I would fertilize them with the same Growing Green or Premium Lawn Food. Either one of those are going to do really well for them as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and you have a really great gardening program. I just love it.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you calling this morning, Charles. I hope you'll do it again anytime I can help. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye. Goodbye.
All right, let me get my last break of the hour out of the way, and then we'll talk to Mike and Wayne and Liz, and I get to talk to you for a moment about my friends at Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. And again, I don't talk about people unless I know them. In the case of Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, I was so glad that I found them probably close to 20 years ago. At that time, I needed a new roof on my home, and they did a beautiful job. My home is a little complex. It's a 110-year-old house with three chimneys and balcony rounds, three sides upstairs, lots of hips and valleys. Man, they gave me a wonderful price on it. They did the work quickly, and I've not had to call them back one single time. Not one, never even a minor leak. My roof's been through hail. It's been through high winds. Had a tornado go through pretty close to the property. Didn't bother mine at all. I have lightning rods on my home, and when they put the metal roof on, they not only took them off carefully, they actually call bonded lightning protection and had them come back and do the reinstallation just to be sure the job was perfect. We have Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof on Shades of Green here that stood up to baseball size hail with no damage. And so many friends and just everybody. The two comments that I hear about them is, I love my roof, and the second one is, I didn't know it'd be so reasonably priced. If you want to put on the last roof you will ever put on your home, if you want to save money on your energy bill every month, if you want a discount on your homeowner's insurance from most companies, well, you need to get a Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof, and you can learn a lot more by giving them a call at 210-822-6868. That's 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. All right, let's get back to the phone lines and get back to gardening. It's going to be Mike and Wayne and Liz, and Mike is up first. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bob. How you doing?
I'm fantastic. How about you today?
I'm pretty good, just in the parking lot of the golf course, fixing to go out and play.
Well, I was just talking to my engineer a few minutes ago, and we were talking about the fact how about 150 years ago, Mark Twain described the game of golf as a good walk spoiled. And so,
Isn't that true?
Yeah, I won't tell you about the other one that I saw on a wall in a production studio in Florida one time. But great game if you've got the time to play it, and but it will teach you patience, and it'll teach you humility. So I hope you're on your game today, and you take your friend's money away from them. How's that?
I'll try. So
what can I help you with today?
I've got a backyard full of TIF Bermuda, and it's been there about 10 years. And now it looks like it's being invaded by a kind of a low-growing weed. It's kind of it's shovel-shaped, and it's got little yellow flowers on it. And it's
it's called
killing my Bermuda.
It's, well, it's called, if you don't like it, you call it straggler daisy. If you like it, you call it horse herb. You need to mow a little more often. You need to fertilize a little bit more often because TIF is one Bermuda grass that, well, that's what you're going to be walking around on the greens out there. So, it can stand being mowed low, whereas that horse herb cannot stand low mowing. And, unless your yard's gotten shady, the TIF Bermuda with a little fertilizer, a little bit of water will totally choke that out. There's nothing, there are no sprays that are safe to use on it in the summer months. Now, one thing about your TIF is the first heavy frost this fall, your TIF's going to turn brown. That horse herb is probably going to stay green. And when that happens, you can go through there and spray with your orange oil and vinegar and kill the horse herb back. But you have to wait till the TIF browns out before you can do that, because orange oil and vinegar won't hurt brown grass, but it will hurt anything that's got green foliage. So those are going to be my three suggestions. Mow lower, fertilize probably a little bit more often with a good organic fertilizer, and after we get the first couple of frosts, go through and spray with vinegar and orange oil, and you should knock it back to the point you'll be totally rid of it next year.
Good. Well, thanks, Bob.
And good luck with your game today. I appreciate the call, Mike. Thank you so much.
He always wins. Okay.
Very good. All right, sir. Well, moving along, let's see here. Wayne is up next. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning, Bob.
Hi, Wayne. Morning, sir.
Hey, I've got some I've come up for my weekly or biweekly instruction on cuttings.
Okay.
I have been using perlite, and I was making some progress, and then I started getting some I guess it's some molding or some weak plants. Basically started rotting, it looked like, from the bottom, and I'm thinking it's probably just because I must have been watering, been spritzing too much. I've got everything in a 10/20 tray with packs, and I've got a dome over it. It's mm-hmm. got some venting, but I'm starting to see some rotting of these plants, and you know, some of them have been in there for about 4 weeks.
Okay, what kind of plants are we trying to root, Wayne?
Lantana, shrimp plant. Basically, those are two good ones. I mean, the lantana, shrimp plant.
And how much light have you got your propagating tray in?
I've got them sitting in a right next to a window up in my attic.
Okay. I would move them outside. It's just indoors. It's hard to get enough light. And they do like some air circulation. Having a dome over them, just venting is not enough. They, you know, if I were going to try to do it indoors, I'd actually have a bigger area, and I'd have a little fan blowing on them. I don't think it has much to do with the water, because water doesn't hurt anything. Lack of oxygen is what hurts things. And the perlite is so open that you're never – I mean, the commercial growers, people like one I'll be seeing tomorrow, and they've got a greenhouse that's probably 100 by 100 feet that's all mist benches, and their misters come on 10, 15 times a day in the warm weather. So I don't think we're looking at water issues, but much more likely we've got an issue with not enough air circulation and not enough light. Be sure,
okay,
and I'm sure you do this, but strip the lower leaves off. But until it gets really chilly, I would have those cuttings outside rather than inside. And actually, best of all worlds, unless we're really getting down close to freezing, would have them outside with a propagating mat. If you had the tops cool and the lower stems and the perting rooting medium warm, that's what the big guys that do millions of color cuttings, that's what they aim for.
Okay. All right. Well, then I'll make those changes, and hopefully I'll be able to report back good stuff to you in the next couple of weeks.
Well, it won't happen overnight, but I'm really pretty sure that's the only thing that you've got going on. I don't think it's excessive water, but you're never going to have too much air circulation as long as you're not blowing the cuttings out of the medium. they want as much air circulation as they can possibly get. And short of blazing hot sunlight, they want it to be really, really bright. And I've seen what you're seeing, and it's always really just a matter of stale air and too little light, and those are both very correctable problems.
Very good. I appreciate it, Bob. You have a good weekend.
You do the same, Wayne. It's always good to talk to you. Thank you, sir. And goodbye. All right, only about 60 seconds till news time. So, Liz, I'm going to make you up first after the news. I'm going to remind everybody else, in addition to fertilizing, we're still seeing some late grubworm activity. If you've seen June bugs around late in the year, might consider one more application of beneficial nematodes. I put them out about 2 weeks ago because I had a flea issue. No more fleas, I can tell you that. Usually when I treat for fleas, it's like 2-3 years before I have to treat again. But nothing wrong with putting out some beneficial nematodes this time of year. And keep in mind, most plants do not want to be pruned at this time of year because you run the risk of creating a bunch of tender new growth coming out that would then freeze back. So pretty much prune, put away the pruning shears, especially for any major pruning. It is a fine time to prune trees if you need to, but remember, only trees that you need to seal the wounds on are live oaks and that whole group of trees we call red oaks. Other trees, it actually slows down healing rather than speed it up. So don't let anybody tell you pruning paint's a good thing. It's absolutely necessary on those two types of oaks, but other things, just leave it in the tool chest. And so much more to tell you. We'll do that after news here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, once again, we are back to gardening, and it's just such a nice Saturday morning. I love this kind of time of year when you get up and you may have to put a long sleeve shirt on that you'll probably be shedding before the day's over. And I love the fact they're actually giving us a decent chance of rain a little bit later this week, because that's the one complaint, is we are so dry. We very, very definitely need some rain. But the temperature's going to be chillier next week. If you've got things outside like Chinese evergreens or Dieffenbachias or the true aralias like your chicken gizzard and your Ming trees and things like that, they very definitely need to come in. If you've got flowering plants like Apicias, if you have your Phalaenopsis outside, Cattleyas can take what's coming next week. But Phalaenopsis and Vandas, those guys really going to need to come inside. So take a look at all the things that you may have on your porch and patio, because this is really the first time this season we're looking at some weather that's going to be cool enough that it could potentially cause a problem for some of those plants. But anyway, enough of me. I'm more interested in what is on your mind. So we're going to talk to Liz and Ezel and John, and Liz is up first. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning. How are you, Bob?
I'm wonderful. How are you today?
Well, I'm a little worried about some of my plants that I've gotten to where they look decent, because I don't have a green thumb.
Well, I once
so
heard
I
a green thumb is...
You.
Well, I'm here to help you. How can I help?
Well, I have a poinsettia that has been doing really good through the summer and fall, and it's real green with the aloe vera and a firm asparagus and a prayer plant. And I wanted to know, now that the weather's going to get cooler, what should I do? Do I bring them inside? Do I keep them out there? Or what do I do with them?
Well, everything you mentioned can certainly go down near freezing without any damage. Your asparagus fern will actually go below freezing without damage. The most important thing that you do with your poinsettia this time of year is to be certain that it's not getting any light at night. You don't want it sitting near a porch light or anywhere that the lights are going to be on at night. Because the thing that makes a poinsettia turn color around Christmas time is going from long days to short days. And poinsettias have a very specific way, it's called the phytochrome system, of measuring how long the day length is. And if you have them near your porch light or something, they're going to think it's July, and they're never going to turn red or pink or white or whatever the appropriate color is. So be sure that your poinsettia is in an area that it gets the normal day length. If you have to bring it inside, then you either have to keep it in a sunny room where you don't turn on the lights in the evening, or some people will actually put them in the closet every afternoon, bring them back out the next morning. But having those long nights and short days, that's what's going to make your poinsettia color up as we get closer to Christmas time. But your aloe will have to come in when it freezes, but not until it freezes. And same way with your poinsettia. I would protect your poinsettia from any real strong winds, because poinsettias are a little brittle, and I've seen them sometimes get broken up in the wind. But no, just keep up your watering. Get a good plant food like Has to Grow or something like that, and be fertilizing them regularly. But just keep on doing what you're doing. It sounds like you're doing fine. Your thumb's getting greener all the time.
Yeah, and it's getting bigger. So should I move it or leave it still in the same pot? Because it's gotten pretty big, the poinsettia.
I would probably wait until spring to repot it. I don't want you to shock it at all right now when it's thinking about putting on all this beautiful holiday color. So I tend to do my repotting right in the end of winter, just as I'm bringing things out when they're getting ready to put on their spring growth. So it won't hurt to repot it if you want to, but if it were mine, I'd wait and do it in the spring.
Okay. Also, my other question is, I've had some perennials that I bought. They were small, and they died on me because the area was not really sunny. They would get sun in the morning, and then later on it was shady, so not really that much sun.
Well, there are perennials that'll be happy in that situation. Shrimp plant should do well in that situation. There are some salvias that take a lot of sun, but there are other salvias that are happy in the shade. There's one they call eyelash sage. I was just looking at those out back yesterday. Bright red flowers. How do you spell that one? Like your eyelashes? Eyelash sage. I won't even try to spell this properly.
Are they bushes?
Yes, they're low bushes.
That's what I wanted. Do they come back every year?
They usually don't even freeze down, but if they do, they come right back.
Yeah, because I wanted something that's colorful, that's a bushy plant that come back every year because it's kind of shady a little bit.
Yeah, there's another beautiful plant which is called fire spike. Now, don't confuse it with fire bush. Fire bush needs the sun, but fire spike, properly called Odontonema, it's just starting to come into flower. It blooms with big spikes of red flowers. There's also a pink form, but the most common one is red. Fire spike is another beautiful green shrubby plant. Now, it will freeze down most winters, but it comes right back out in the spring. But it is very happy in the shade.
Mm-hmm. Do they attract butterflies? I wanted something that attracts butterflies.
Well, yes, they do, but now the fire spike in particular doesn't really start blooming until fall, and most of the butterflies are kind of moving on through. We don't get as many butterflies in the middle of the winter, but they do, and the salvia eyelash sage attracts butterflies, and the shrimp plant attracts butterflies and hummingbirds. There's another salvia they call tropical sage, Salvia coccinea. It is one, my business partner had one in her yard, and she lives on acreage as well. And now it's just little bright red flowers coming up, and the little area outside her fence, but around her home, it just is coming up everywhere, and it blooms all summer with red flowers. So tropical sage is another one of those salvias that will freeze down but comes back every year.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I notice I have some sun in the morning, not that much, and then it's shady. So those perennials really didn't grow. They died on me.
There are lots of perennials that need some, but the ones I'm telling you about, these are perennials that are happy in the shade. So just be sure you're getting your plants, not at the grocery store, but for somebody that can tell you which ones like the shade, because they're perennials that they'll just thrive in your yard. We've just mentioned a few of them, these things should do very, very well for you.
Okay. My last question is, what should I put on the grass that has some dried up grass with brown spots? They've never done really good. There's a certain area that keeps doing that.
I would put some good organic fertilizer and put some compost, but at some point next spring, we ought to try to figure out whether you've got fungus or grub worms. Not normal to have brown spots, and there's usually a cause for it. But in general, in the fall, I recommend just good organic fertilizer and then a thin layer of compost over those areas to help the grass come back.
And the name brand?
There's several good ones. My two favorites are Medina and Nature's mm-hmm. Creation. Medina makes okay. one called Growing Green. Nature's Creation makes one called Premium Lawn Food. Both of them are organic. Both of them can be used 365 days a year, and neither one of them has to be watered in. They don't really go to work until they get water, but, you know, the synthetic chemical types, you better be watering them in or they're going to burn things. Neither one of these will burn. You can just wait for the rain, or you can just water it on your next cycle. There's no rush to have to run out and water.
And that should take care of the brown or dried up
area? I can't tell you that without knowing what caused the brown spots. But it will certainly help your grass stay green, and will help it grow back into those damaged areas.
Okay. Do I put it now, or do I wait till a certain time?
Wait till I'm off the air and Dr. Kirby's show is finished. I'd wait till at least noon. I'm teasing you, Liz. You can put it on any time. Now is a great time to do it. There's no reason to wait. But do stay close to the radio until we finish your radio shows, and then you can go get your fertilizer and put it on.
Okay. Going back real quick, on those that you told me, the trim, the eyeless sage, and fire spike, do you water them once you plant them every day or every other day?
Well, you water them very thoroughly when you can stick your finger in the soil and it's dry, good and dry, about an inch deep. I can't tell you every day or every other day, because if it's hot and windy, you're going to have to water more often. If it's cloudy and chilly, you're not going to have to water as often. So when you water, water thoroughly, and then just periodically mm-hmm. go out and feel the soil at the base of the plant. If it feels like it's drying out, it's time to water again.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so very much, Bob. You have a blessed day.
You do the same. Always a pleasure visiting with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Certainly. Goodbye. All right. Well, it's already 10:16. Ezell and John, let me get a break out of the way here, and I'll be right back with you guys. I get to talk about Wild Birds Unlimited. And, you know, shouldn't be flowers is the only beautiful thing out in your yard. If you like wildlife, you would be amazed at the beautiful color and life you can bring in with the different birds. Whether it's the hummingbirds in the summer, whether it's those beautiful orioles that migrate through, whether it's the American goldfinches that come in and spend the winter with us, there are just a lot of things that will really add life and color to your yard. Wild Birds Unlimited is the one store in town where you're always going to get good advice and top quality products. They have certainly the best feeders there. They even have some that have what's called a silver iodide technology built in that keeps the seed from molding and going bad inside the feeder. They've got hummingbird feeders that have built-in ant stoppers, and you can get bee guards for them. Plus, when it comes to the actual feed, the seed, Wild Birds Unlimited has the freshest, cleanest seed around. And Kyle and his staff, they can tell you which seed blends will bring in certain birds, which seed blends will exclude the birds you don't want, like the white-winged doves and the grackles and things like that. There's a lot to know about birding, and the folks at Wild Birds Unlimited will happily help you. But they're a lot more than a bird store. Tremendous selection of gifts. They've got tilly hats. They've got wind chimes. Wonderful books. You just need to go see them. Open 7 days a week out in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, right there on the side that faces Northwest. I'm sorry, not I-10 and Callahan. Right there at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner is where Wild Birds Unlimited is. The side that faces Northwest Military, that's where you find Wild Birds Unlimited. They've been there for a lot of years. They're open 7 days a week. And if you ever have a question, give them a call, 210-648-BIRD, 210-648-BIRD for Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Going to be Ezell, John, and Jerry. Ezell is up first. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Bob. Great morning this morning. Nice and cool. It feels really great.
I can't wait to get back out into it.
Yeah, me too, and do a little bit more gardening. I have some questions. I've I've rooted plants in water, and then I got to the point where I said, well, you know, I want to grow some of them in water.
Okay.
And I've got some snake plants, and they're doing well. I've got other, I forget what the other plant is. It's doing well. But one of the problems I'm having is the one plant that I can't ever, it keeps dying is a philodendron. Now, the leaves or the stalks, the ones I'm trying to use are the split leaf.
Uh-huh.
But they keep turning yellow. And well, I read that you could change the water every 6 days or whatever, no chlorine. I try that, but they still die. Is that not a good one to try and root in water and grow?
Well, see, a plant develops a different root system in water than it does in soil. And if you root something in water and then transfer it to soil, all those water roots die and the plant has to start over again making soil roots. But most plants, if they are rooted in water and you leave them in water, most of them could spend their whole life growing in water. That's a whole science we call hydroponics. And, you know, people grow a lot of different things. Now, the so-called split-leaf philodendron, are you talking about the one that makes a vine or the one that more or less has a central stem and the leaves go out in all directions?
Well, the leaves go in all directions and they get pretty big.
Okay. Well, the thing with that plant, it'll be happy in your swimming pool as long as it doesn't have chlorine in it. But the point is, it doesn't do well in a small container. That one is Philodendron psylloum. And if I were going to grow it in water, I would want it in, in something the size of a bathtub for it to really do well. It doesn't do well in a small container, and it may just be that your container you're growing it in just isn't big enough for it. But I've seen that plant, you know, people that have lily ponds and things like that. I've seen the psylloums growing that way, and they do just fine. But I don't really consider that one to be really very practical just because they get so huge. And the other plant that they call split-leaf philodendron, which is actually called Monstera, it's more in the vining philodendron type, but that thing will have leaves that are 3 feet across when that thing is mature. So once again, unless you've got a waterfall in an indoor koi pond or something like that, those guys may just simply take more water volume and more area than you have for them. They can grow in water, but they're really not a windowsill plant.
Right. I saw one in Portugal at one of the Marriott hotels, and they had a huge clear pot, and they were stuck in there, and they were huge. And that's when I first got the idea of trying to grow one. But I've just taken the small leaves and tried to get them to not die, but even those just keep dying.
Well, now that plant doesn't really root well from cuttings. Those are almost 100% of the time. Those are grown from seeds. And you won't do very well unless you take just the whole top out of a plant. That's one of them not going to do very well as a cutting, because, like I say, all the commercial people, they grow that one from seeds only. There's a laboratory technique called tissue culture that is sometimes used, but now those just aren't real successful from cuttings. There's some things that just, the science of it is, to me, is just fascinating. If you take a Scheflera, you can root a leaf off of a Scheflera, but it'll never make a plant. It'll only be a rooted leaf. And a Hoya is the same way. But if you take a piece of the stem and root it, you get a whole new plant. So a person can spend a lifetime studying, all the different plants and all the means of propagations. There's a book that's about 1,000 pages long called the Ball Red Book that basically talks about propagation and culture on every plant you can possibly imagine. So, fortunately or unfortunately, they're just the same technique doesn't work for every plant out there, and you're learning that. Fortunately, you're going to kill a few plants in learning it, but what you're experiencing is not abnormal. You're just trying to propagate a plant that doesn't grow from leaf cuttings, and you're keeping it in a situation that's not big enough for it to really grow. So I'm glad you asked the question. I'm glad I had a chance to tell you what's frustrating you there.
Yeah, well, so on the, thank you, Bob, but on those that they are growing well in water, I find it to fertilize them every so often, every six sure. months, every year, just a little couple of drops of Medina or what, liquid or what?
I will tell you what I do, and I do this where I'm, you know, rooting something that I want to keep in water or give to a friend in water. I will add a little bit of fertilizer to the water, and about 24 hours later, I will pour everything out and put fresh water in there. I don't really like any kind of fertilizer. I don't like, unless it's a really big pond or something like that, I don't like just putting fertilizer in and leaving it, because sometimes it'll stimulate algae growth and things like that. So plants that you are growing in water, if you want to use Hester Grow, it's a great fertilizer to use, but put it in, leave them for a few hours, and then pour it out and replace it with fresh water. It's like you enjoy eating, but you don't want to live with your life in the food dish. You want to eat and then go on with other things, and your plants are sort of the same way.
Okay, thank you. One last thing. I decided this year, I live out north, so 1604, about 8 miles in Timberwood Park, and I decided to plant one of my bougainvilleas. I had grown it so it would go up a stick. And that thing is about four foot tall, and I put it on the south side of the house, near the house. And if it freezes, it'll probably freeze, but will it come back?
Well, of course, depends on how hard it freezes. If it gets to 20 degrees, it's probably going to freeze down and then come right back out next spring. If it gets to 10 degrees, it could die. Now, it's not likely to get to 10 degrees, but I've lived here when it did. So I would always keep some mulch around the base of the plant for the winter, whether it's just shredded up leaves, whether it's, you know, just any kind of mulch material to keep that lower part of the stem warm, so that even if the top of the plant freezes, it'll have something left to come out. You can also, depending on how big it is, you could just cover it with some insulate or one of the floating row covers, something like that. Because we're not likely to have a freeze that would kill it, but, you know, this is Texas. Don't ever take anything for granted.
Right. Well, it's kind of small right now. I've seen some on the south side of town that are up to the eaves of the house. So guess once it gets that big, it could also freeze all the way down, right? If it gets too cold, you can't cover that.
Well, and you're exactly right. Some people think, oh, when it gets grown up, it'll be more cold hardy. No, it doesn't work that way. But I'm thinking over here where we are, I drive down North New Braunfels virtually every day, going down to Dr. Kirby's and places like that. And there are a couple of bougainvilleas on there that come up over the fence. And just these things are absolutely gorgeous. And every year they freeze down to about 5 feet tall, which is the height of the fence. But by this time, they're 12, 15 feet tall and have hundreds of flowers on them. So they're very practical, but the farther you go north, and you're probably on average 5 to 10 degrees colder, and if you went on up to Fredericksburg, it'd be another 5 to 10 degrees colder. And if you headed north and west, you might, you know, get up where it gets down to zero with some regularity. So I think you're fine to plant them out there, Zell, but I'd just be watching that weather forecast and covering when it's has the potential to be really severe.
All right. Well, I decided I'd try one of them. I have several, so we'll see.
Yeah.
But anyway, okay, Bob. Thank you so much for your help. You're always very helpful.
It's always a pleasure. It's good to hear from you. Thank you, sir.
Take
goodbye.
Care.
Bye. All right. Back to gardening once again on a nice Sunday morning. Oh, just looking outside at the animals and people enjoying the kitty cats and the pretty flowers. It's a great day out there, and anyway, appreciate the calls. We're going to talk to John and then to Jerry, and John's up first. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir.
I've got a weed problem. It's only on the strip of grass that's near the road.
Okay. What kind of grass? What kind of weeds?
Okay. The weeds are tall, like almost like a straw, but they're thin.
Uh-huh.
And I guess they're about maybe 2 feet high. They grow that.
What
I've been
you're
cutting them
at
back to a lawnmower, but they grow back again. But that's the only place I got them.
Yep.
You're
looking at one of the toughest. It's a grass. And it's called KR Blue Stem or King Ranch Blue Stem, or there's another one similar called Kleberg Blue Stem. And that stuff was developed to be the hardiest and toughest grass in the world down on the King Ranch, which is where, you know, the name comes from. And unfortunately, it's so hardy and so tough that it's just almost impossible to get rid of once you get it started. And there's just nothing you can spray on it. I've got it in my front yard. I keep it mowed down, but my front yard's largely natural, so I just keep it down to avoid the rattlesnakes. If you really want to get rid of it, you're almost going to have to go out there with a grubbing hoe and just chomp out. It's a clumping grass. It's not a grass that spreads. It doesn't make runners, doesn't spread underground or anything like that. But that one little clump of it is so tough that I swear nothing short of an atom bomb is going to get rid of it. But you almost have to go out there. And unfortunately, what you're seeing up tall, those are the seed heads, and it's throwing seeds out everywhere. If you mow it down enough, and if you can get some other grasses growing in there, they will eventually choke it out. But it's doing just exactly what it's intended to do. It was developed to be one of the hardiest grasses. It didn't care if it was hot or dry or wet or dry or hot or cold. And so read about KR Bluestem or King Ranch Bluestem if you'd like. But the only way you're going to get rid of it is to get out there with a grubbing hoe and chop it out.
All right. Well, you saved me some time, so I don't have to go out there and put anything on it.
No, sir. Wouldn't do any good
okay,
anyway.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is on nematodes. I've been getting my nematodes from the ones that are they're alive.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know if I like to put them out when it's going to rain.
Yes, sir.
How long can I keep them in the refrigerator?
About 2 weeks.
Okay.
That's what they tell us is about 2 weeks. You know, we get a fresh shipment of them every week, and sometimes we run out because we always want to have really fresh ones available. But that's what they tell us is don't keep them in the refrigerator over 2 weeks. And they're okay. Still the most effective. They're the best blend out there. I know a lot of nurseries want to sell the dry ones because they can keep them on the shelf for months, but they're just not as effective. But, whenever I take them home, I usually don't take them home until I'm ready to put them out, but if for some reason I get delayed, I always take a magic marker and write the date on them, and so I'll remember to get them put out. And every year I have plenty of people call me and say, I found them in the back of my refrigerator, and I don't know how long they've been there, but if it's been over about 2 weeks, it's time to get some fresh ones.
Okay. All right. I want to give you a fishing story. My daughter went to Alaska as a petroleum engineer.
Yeah.
And they told her they were going to go deep sea fishing. And she had never been fishing. So she said that she got on this boat. They said, we're going to recognize the whoever catches the biggest fish and the smallest one. And so they tied a big chunk of meat on the and they bounced it along the bottom of the ocean.
Uh-huh.
But she said she noticed that they had several rifles in the boat.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, you'll see why we need these. Anyway, she caught the smallest fish. It was only 75 pounds.
Was it a halibut? Is that what
they're
fishing
for? That's
what it was,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, they had to shoot these halibut before they put them in the boat because they bounce around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you know what? Yeah. When I was fishing with a friend up there, and we caught some, not anything that big, but I was real interested that, and we use cut bait, but you know what you spray your bait with before you put it in the water? You spray it with WD-40. Because WD-40 is essentially a fish oil, and it makes the bait more attractive to the halibut and other things. Been a few years since I've been up there fishing, but that's your story and my story, and I'll let you go, John. Let me get my last break of the show out of the way, and we'll talk to Jerry.
There's a reason I don't play Augusta, and the FedEx Cup passes me by. I hit thin, I hit fat, and I got a high handicap. Yeah, I know the score never lies, but there's always that one shot, the one that fills you with joy. Yeah, straight down the middle, yeah, I've solved the riddle, and I think I'm McIlroy. But I don't have Tiger's talent, I can't hit get a flop shot like Phil. I don't drive it like TJ, but I think that someday if I hit the gym, maybe I will. If I only had more time to practice, if I just had those clubs on TV. Oh, it fills me with hope behind these big ropes, thinking someday that could be me. Then life gets in the way.
Oh, no, that's not a fishing song, but it's a good song. It's, you know, that just, God, I hate to hear that we lost Jerry Jeff Walker this weekend. You know, talk about people that put a smile on your face and put a song in your heart. There's just some good songs out there, and appreciate the little lift you give us on Sunday mornings there. Yeah, I'm sure there are plenty of people golfing out there, and they probably just missed a shot because they're laughing so hard at that at that song. Well, let's get back to gardening for just a few minutes here, and Jerry is up next, and it'll be Joshua and Harry are. I can't read my writing once again. Yeah, Harry, to finish up. So, good morning, Jerry.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm good, sir. How about yourself?
Doing okay. Hey, a quick compost question. I wanted to go and pick up a load of compost. And one of the concerns I had, I was looking at the rain or the forecast. That if it's going to rain like they said, I know I want compost that's, I don't want to say aged or cold, but do I want to wait for a while after it's rained? Because I'm thinking that some of that, I'm going to call it that nutrients or whatever you want to call it, is washed out of that. Or do what I'm trying to ask?
No, I see what you're trying
to ask. When do I do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And no, I would not wait because in all honesty, you're getting in compost, you're more concerned about the microbial life that you're bringing in than you are about the actual nutrients. Compost is actually fairly low in nutrient, and the main nutrient that is in there is ammonia. And ammonia is going to turn to a gas and go away. So the best thing that could happen would be for it to get a good rain on top of it to put that ammonia back into a liquid form and carry it down into the ground where the plants would make use of it. And so, no, I would love to, I would love to get compost on right before a good rain. But it also brings up the point, really, it doesn't substitute for fertilizing. The amount of nutrient in there is not really adequate for what most plants need in South Texas. So it doesn't replace your fertilizer, and rainfall will only make it better. So no reason to put it off. Today would be a great day to do it. That answer the question? I think Jerry may have either hit mute on his phone or dropped off. Jerry, you still with us? Okay, I think he cut himself off, but hopefully he's listening on the radio. But no, rainfall after compost would be a good thing rather than a bad thing. So I would not hesitate to put it on this today, tomorrow, whenever you can get it. I would give you one other bit of advice as far as types of compost. I'm not a fan of biosolids compost. I like most all compost out there. I don't object to the fact that biosolids is human sewage waste, but problem with what goes down our sewers these days is all the pharmaceuticals, all the chemicals, all the nasty things that really have nothing to do with the sludge itself. So that's why I stay away from biosolids compost, but you make your own choice. But I'll take a good manure compost or, you know, a good blended compost. And I have to tell you, generally across the board, if you're looking for compost in a bag, my favorite is from Nature's Creation. If you're looking for bulk compost, I like some of the products they sell at Stone and Soil Depot. I think they've got like 6 locations now, so there's one probably fairly close to you. All right, having said that, let's get back to the phone lines, and Joshua is up next. Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning, sir. How are we doing today?
Hey, it's just a good day, and, you know, it's just actually an outstanding day as far as I'm concerned. Nice weather, lots of things to do outside, and nice cool temperature, but not cold enough to cause any problems.
No, I hear you. I'm out here. You know, it's pretty nice, and hopefully we'll get a little bit of the sun out today. But I'm going to try to be quick so the last caller gets a chance.
Okay.
We recently got a bunch of different vegetables, you know, and fruits, you know, so we have like tomatoes and bell peppers and jalapenos and all this stuff. Right now they're all in pots, and we bought a bunch of old tractor tires, like really big tires, and painted them up. Uh-huh. And we're going to put the, we want to plant them in there because, one, our ground soil is not the greatest, and two, it's to help my mom who can't get too low all the time.
Sure.
So these
sure.
should sit there. Now, the other couple of weekends ago, you were talking with a gentleman about these heating pads to put under the potting plants to keep the soil at a temperature the plants would like. Is there a thing, is there some kind of a system we could do that where we could like line the inside of the tires with like a type of coils or something that we could use to keep the soil at a good temperature during the cold winter?
Well, that's an interesting question, and no, it's really not practical. I mean, in a greenhouse where we're growing things in pots, they actually put heating tubes in the floor of the greenhouse. They put in plastic PVC pipe, and they actually force hot water back and forth through those pipes, and it keeps the floor warm, but it doesn't keep the top of the plant from freezing and dying. It would only work inside of a greenhouse. So unfortunately, you know, we have cool season plants and we have warm season plants, but virtually all your vegetables, virtually everything in the garden is going to have a productive season of anywhere from 2 months to 6 or 8 months. But we're just, this is the time of year to get close and to kissing your peppers and your tomatoes and your eggplant goodbye, because we'll be planting those fresh again next spring. But the good news is, bad news is that they're just done for the season, and there's not a lot you can do to change that. The good news is that it's now time to plant broccoli and cauliflower and chard and Brussels sprouts and cabbage and kale and mustard and radishes and beets and carrots and turnips, and they're in getting close to time to plant onions. There are a whole lot of things that you can plant and your family can enjoy too, but you're really going to be disappointed big time trying to continue to grow your tomatoes and peppers. The only way that you make it through a winter with one of those is to have a heated greenhouse, and again, it's not really practical. So I sure wouldn't spend a lot of time and energy trying to save those plants, because we're just getting toward the end of the season that they're going to produce no matter what you do. But like I say, that's the bad news. The good news is there are a bunch of things that love the winter, probably more things you can plant in the winter than you can plant in the summer, in truth.
Okay. Do I have to worry about, like, so does that mean those plants are going to die, or can I still at least cover them and keep them protected so that I still have them when the season starts again? Like, do I just write those off and have to buy new plants?
Yeah, you do with tomatoes and peppers and eggplants. Plants get their own form of hardening of the arteries, so to speak, and even if you kept them alive through the winter months, they would be, you know, they'd be like, well, I don't know exactly what a good analogy would be, but they certainly would not produce very well, you know, the second time around. Now, some plants
gotcha.
You can take cuttings from. What we call indeterminate tomatoes, you could take cuttings from those and root those and grow them through the winter and plant them next spring. You could actually take cuttings from some of your different peppers would grow from cuttings. But the big plants are pretty much done for. Mother Nature meant for them to live for one season, and we can't really artificially prolong that.
Okay, thank you so much, and y'all stay blessed.
Well, you do likewise. And if you're ever over our way, we have a little gardening guide that we love to share with people, especially people just getting started with it, that will tell you when it's time to plant all the different things. We have our recommended planting dates for fall, our recommended planting dates for spring. We have a little notation on there as which ones are best to set out as plants, which ones grow well from seed. There's just so much to know, and so many mistakes to avoid. So love to help you any way we can. I appreciate your listening, and please don't hesitate to call anytime. But get that garden ready, because like I say, right now you could be planting lettuce, you could be planting Swiss chard, you could be planting kale, you could be planting broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, you could be planting radishes, beets, carrots, turnips. You could be planting, October's the month to plant garlic. If you like garlic, man, this is the best time going to plant garlic. Next month we'll be planting onion transplants, and we harvest something out of the garden almost every day of the year, but it changes from winter to summer. So don't you hesitate to call anytime I can help y'all. Appreciate it, Joshua. Thank you. All right, let's finish up the calls today with Harry. Good morning, Harry.
Hey, what's up, man?
Just another nice fall Sunday out there. It's just going to be a great day.
It's nice, but I got stuff to do. But Ma, her, she has about, this may be a better question for the doctor, but she got a mini pen. We had to build a pen for her to keep her in the yard. Uh-huh. Is there some kind of barrier we can put around the bottom of the cyclone fence to keep her from getting out and going next door?
Well, believe it or not, a number of years ago when I lived in San Antonio, my next door neighbor had a beagle that loved to dig under the fence and come into my yard, which I didn't mind that much, but the most effective way to do that is just with a hot wire. You know, just a little miniature electric fence. You can go to a feed store, and, you know, it's not really wire anymore. What I use in my vegetable garden to keep some of the varmints out, it's like a polypropylene cord. It's like almost like a rope, a very thin rope that has the little tiny, tiny wires through it. And you use, they make a little plastic device that you can screw into the fence, and then you just simply feed this through it. It's an insulator, of course. And then you just put a simple fence charger. It can be either plug-in or battery-powered. And if you've ever grabbed an electric fence, you know it'll get your attention, but it really won't hurt you. And that it would be a very simple, very inexpensive process just to run a single wire all the way around the perimeter of the yard, and about 5 inches
off
the
ground. It's a big perimeter.
Well,
it's going to be a couple hundred feet.
Well, again, compared to the cost of trying to put, you know, hardware cloth or chicken wire or something down there, it's a lot easier. My business partner years ago had a Great Dane that thought it was fun to, you know, eat the window frames and things like that. And she actually, you know, put it up, you know, around the windows to keep Jesse from trying to tear the boards off. But, now if you want to spend, you know, substantial amount of money, there is a really neat system called Invisible Fence. And what they do is they have a cable that they actually bury in the ground, and then the dog wears a collar, and every time it approaches that underground cable, it gets just a little buzz, and nobody even sees it or anything else. But I tell you, that dog will not get within 3 feet of the fence. But you're looking at, you know, spending a couple of $100 minimum to do that. Nice thing about it, if you ever move, you can dig it up and take it with you. So that would be the option that I know Dr. Kirby would use and recommend, is Invisible Fence. But again, it's a little pricey. If you're looking for a do-it-yourself job, you can go to any good farm and ranch store. And like I say, nowadays we don't use bare wire anymore. We use something that looks like just a cord that has the little wires in it. Very easy to do. You're probably going to pay $40 or $50 for the fence charger, but the whole rest of the system is probably going to cost you under $20. So that would be, you know, even a super active dog like a min pen would be a great way to
Will they have solar too?
You have a battery, but you can put a solar charger on that battery so that you never have to do anything with it.
Okay.